All right, we got rid of the Ronco mic. How's this one? Is this one better?
Much better.
Much
better. All right, good. Let's go to Tom Rivers live in London. And, Tom, I started to lay out some of the details, but no one could hear them. So tell us what happened last night.
Yeah, we had a count of about 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles fired off of the two destroyers stationed in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. The target, an airfield in Syria, and Homs, just outside north of Damascus. And by all accounts, about six people died. I guess it would have been telegraphed that something might be coming tonight. And most of the people at that base got out of harm's way before those missiles got in there. But seeing some pictures, too, today released by Syrian television, you can see some pretty extensive damage to some of the hangars, some of the fuel bunkers, etc.
ABC News, your employer and our friends are reporting that the warning allowed Syria to clear out some of their own equipment as well as people. Do we know anything more about that?
Well, again, certainly it looks like it. Anecdotally, people on the ground there said that people started, you know, getting out of the base about 2 hours before this strike. So somebody telegraphed something. Somebody knew something was up.
There's a back channel, Andrea, to Russia to prevent our planes from running into each other.
Right.
Which supposedly was activated last night. And obviously Russia could then pick up the phone and call Syria if that's how it happened. But we're still collecting facts here, right?
As far as I can see, yeah. And Tom, I'm curious why the shift in policy. As we heard maybe 2 days earlier when we learned about this, Sean Spicer holding a news briefing saying, well, you know, President Trump is considering all options, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, in the evening last night, boom.
Well, exactly. We were hearing the same things over here as well. A couple of weeks ago, the British Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, saying, you know, we've been pursuing this for almost 7 years now, regime change. I guess that's the wrong way to proceed. Maybe we're going to get used to Assad and whatever political transition that can evolve out of Geneva. He's going to have to be involved in some way, shape, or form. About 2 hours after this this chemical attack, we see that Boris and the prime minister are really pounding the drum for some kind of action. So a real 180-degree pivot. Certainly here, and we've been seeing that in other countries too. France in support, Germany in support, Italy in support for quote-unquote limited action like this. But I think the underlying sentiment is that they hope that this is just a one-time deal, because many others, critics say, this is not going to move the end of the war one inch closer in and of itself. If anything, you're probably pouring some fuel on the fire. So watch this space. We'll see how it plays out. But, of course, relations between specifically Moscow and Washington, at least in the short term, low again.
Mm-hmm. What is Russia's response?
They call it aggression against a sovereign state. They call it a war crime. They want an emergency Security Council meeting. Immediately, that communication between coalition jets and Russian jets is being broken now. So that could create all kinds of havoc in the skies above Syria. So that's a big problem there. Next week, we've got Foreign Secretary Tillerson heading to Moscow. Hasn't been canceled at this stage of the game. It's going to be a barn burner. Watch that one.
All right, Tom Rivers live in London. And what do you expect we'll hear from President Trump today as he continues to meet with the president of China?
Well, again, if he's, I'm not sure about the scheduling on any presser today. But, yes, certainly this has implications for North Korea as well. It sends a signal out that the U.S. is willing to go it alone, not only in Syria, but you can say, guess what? If all options are on the table, maybe something in the nature of North Korea as well. So certainly to President Xi, Trump is going to try to impress the fact that, say, look, you really this time have to do something to change the course of Pyongyang, because guess what? 20 years of this stuff hasn't created anything. Nothing has been able to convince that government to change its course and its nuclear program.
So much for a slow Friday, huh, Tom?
I tell you, it's been a heck of a week, guys. I tell you, it's been a crazy one, but comes in swings and roundabouts, as they say over here in the UK.
One quick thing before you go, and it's a sad story, but the woman that was fell off the bridge with that terrorist attack on Parliament a couple of weeks ago has apparently died.
The one from Lordy, I think she was from
Romania, right?
Romania. There you go. She was the one who got hit by the car and actually fell into the Thames, and she was plucked from the waters, and was fighting for her life for something like 2 weeks now, over 2 weeks, and sadly we got the word this morning that she has passed away, but that would bring then to five victims in that outrage, and of course the attacker as well, killed as well.
Yeah, 27, 28 years old. Awful. Thank you for the report. We appreciate it. And we'll let you get back to work. That's Tom Rivers, ABC News, live in London at 6:18. Andrea's here. Dave's here. Mm-hmm. Mary's here. Mike and Sandberg are here. And we're on and we're ready to go. Though we'll get to Lou here in just a second. I wanted to just say the following, and I don't want anybody to run off the road. I completely support the president.
What? No,
so
I agree with
this,
you.
The discussion that you're going to hear from a bunch of people today is, well, that's not what he said 3 days ago. That's not what he said when Obama did it years ago. Mm-hmm. None of that matters. None of that matters. Now, what this turns out to be, none of us know. Was there, a specific communication to Putin? Was this all political? Was this, I've got to do this and you've got to accept this? We don't know any of that. What we do know is, as president, with thankfully, the security team he has, with the great generals that he has, thankfully, he listened to them, and a very targeted strike in a very specific way to send a very specific message. And Tillerson, the Secretary of State, who he thought may have been, had lost the ability to speak a few days ago, coming out against Russia right in the face of this meeting, which we just discussed, and his buddy Putin, they're old friends. This is all positive. This is all positive to have America step up and take a stand. Where it goes from here, we're not sure, but you're not going to hear me engaging in, that's not what he said 3 days ago, that's not what he said 2 weeks ago. And the president gets way too much credit and way too much blame for everything. He certainly didn't do this without support, and he certainly didn't do this without, he doesn't know a Tomahawk missile from a skyscraper. But the fact is, he had to make the call in the end, and he did it. So I support the president in doing this and making this decision. Boy, that's a grown up.
I know, very grown up of you.
Absolute silence.
It's, you know what though? You're absolutely right. 59 Tomahawk missiles. It's not about why. It's about moving forward now. So
yeah, and for the sake of those children who were murdered, come on. We're the United States of America. We got to do something. Mm-hmm. All right, 6:20. Mary, do the traffic, and we'll go right to Lou. So get your first caller in 312-981-7200. First caller for Lou is always a winner.
It's Lou's First Call with Lou Manfredini and Steve Cochran. Brought to you by American Weathermakers.
American Weathermakers, we won't be comfortable until you are.
It's the time of the show for Lou's First Call.
That's right, and Lou's First Call, sponsored by American Weathermakers. Lou Manfredini, we're assuming live at Channel 9.
Good morning.
Hi, buddy.
How you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Glad to hear it. You want to know how Andrea is? She's here.
Hi, Andrea. How are
Hi,
you feeling?
Hi, Lou. I'm doing great, thanks. Good. Miss you.
Miss you more.
How about Mary Vandeville? Do you care about Mary?
Mary, I love Mary. I love both Marys. I love Dave.
Hey, thanks,
I love
Lou.
Bennett.
Thanks, Lou. Listen to you.
Steve,
what about
Brzanich?
Mike?
I love Steve.
Yeah, what about Mike Jacobson?
Oh, I like Mike, too.
Bob Ferguson, he said.
Bob Ferguson's to no compare.
Okay. Well, we're out of time.
Give someone a April Air Wi-Fi thermostat.
Yeah. Is it Bob in Streamwood? Am I close to the Bill in Streamwood?
Bill.
Sorry, Bill in Streamwood. You are the first caller. What is your issue, and how can Lou help you?
Hi, Lou and Steve. How you doing?
Great.
We have a concrete slab, and we have carpeting on top of it. Is there any way to insulate it so the coldness doesn't permeate up through the floor?
Not without the concrete slab, like on a porch or something like that?
No, it's like the foundation of the addition.
It's the foundation of the addition, but you have carpeting over the top of the slab.
Right. I mean, if we replace it, is there anything besides electrical heaters that you could put on the floor to make it warmer?
There is there's a plywood system called DryCore that is a 2-foot by 2-foot piece of plywood that has metal It's got like a perforated metal pattern on the bottom, like feet. So it elevates the plywood from the concrete.
Okay.
And what it does is it locks together, not unlike when they put the gym floor down at the Bull, at the United Center for the Bulls. You know, there's sections of hardwood floors that click them together, and they have these little cam locks that put them together. By doing that, if you put that over the top of the concrete, it does two things. If there's ever a little bit of moisture that comes up through it, it'll, you know, it'll keep the moisture from getting to the plywood and or the carpeting. And B, that little bit of separation keeps you off of the cold concrete, and it will, I mean, it won't, it's not like heating the floor, but the floor will not be as cold.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it's called Dry Core, and you get it most lumber yards, maybe a few of the big box stores may carry it as well.
Okay, thanks, Lou.
You got it.
All right, don't hang up, buddy. Don't hang up. We got to get your information for that prize, which Andrea will now describe in great detail.
Oh, we are going to give away the the April Air Wi-Fi thermostat. Allowing
you,
No, I like this one. April Air Wi-Fi thermostat. It, of course, allows you to adjust the temperature of your home's air on your smartphone. Brought to you by American Weathermakers, home of the 60-Minute Men. Just call 855-955-HVAC.
So, Lou, I have
like
Lou, I have a whiny staff question.
Okay.
And, Andre, why don't you check the texters as well, and if anybody else has a whiny staff question, they could jump in.
Sounds good.
There was some drywall that was being cut in my garage for a couple of these rehab projects, and the drywall dust has gotten a lot of places. You know, it's like going to the beach. You find sand six months later.
Right.
Other than you coming over and dusting, is there a, do you recommend like a shop vac? Do you recommend, or am I literally going to have to hand wipe down everything I don't want covered in drywall?
Yeah. So the drywall dust, the problem is it's so fine. And the fact that you're still in the heating season, more than likely when they opened up the garage, you know, the air comes in and now it circulates through the home. I'm actually talking about air, indoor air quality this morning on the WGN TV morning show. So one of the things you need to do is, of course, vacuum as much as you can, but then you're going to need to use either a damp cloth or, you know, the Swiffer type of stuff really does a nice job of collecting dust. And then make sure that you go and change those furnace filters, because I'll guarantee you they're caked on with a bunch of dust and they're not helping you at all to filter the air. And especially, you know, as you're still recovering, we want to make sure the air is fresh.
Absolutely.
So when I cough and it's just a puff of white drywall dust, that's a bad thing?
It's not. It makes for a great cartoon, but it's not good for you.
Means there's a new pope.
Yes.
It is Palm Sunday coming up, so we could just look to Steve and see when he coughs.
Is there
a new pope? We like this pope. We don't want a new one.
We like the pope.
We do like
very
this pope.
Very cool. You want a texter question?
Yeah, give me a texter question.
All right, here we go. Tiling a bathroom floor, do I put RedGuard waterproofing on top of the backer board?
I mean, you could, but for a bathroom floor, I wouldn't worry about it. I think that when it comes to bathroom floors, the biggest mistake that people make is they choose a really light-colored grout that is never going to be that color. If you're dead set on a light-colored grout, then I would highly recommend using an epoxy grout, which stays more flexible, does a better job of keeping the moisture out, and it has better color retention. The only risk there is you have to work very quickly when you're using it to make sure that you're grouting it in properly and wiping it as quickly as possible.
Okay, and we have a text question from someone named Bondria Larless. Wants to know
who that is.
If she's repainting, does she have to take the old paint off in my apartment or scrape it off or just paint right on over it?
So this fictitious woman is painting over. Is she changing? I know it's just
changing
a text.
Changing colors, yeah.
Oh, she is changing colors. It's funny that you know that.
Yes,
So the thing is, the advent of all these paint and primers in one make your life super easy. My recommendation, though, before do any painting, is you need to wipe down the walls a little bit with a damp cloth. Do any kind of scraping, you know, if there's some loose paint, a little light sanding. I'm also a big proponent of just a quick little sand on the wall, literally with a sanding sponge, like almost waving it across there just to take a little of the sheen off of the existing paint.
Okay.
I know this is a lot for you to text back.
Yeah,
to
no, I'm gonna voice.
But and
this
then
is, this is for Bondria, right?
Bondria.
Right. Yes, it's for Bondria.
Bondria Barless, I think that is. Double B, I call
she
it.
She gave her full name too.
Double B.
Southern European.
Mm-hmm. She's right.
No.
And then use one of these paint and primers in one. You know, the I'll tell you, if you go to Ace, my friends at Ace, they've got that Clark and Kensington's really good, as well as the Valspar paint, and it's super sticky, and the colors are really nice.
Mm-hmm. You're super sticky.
You are. You are.
I would paint white if I were you. Tell that girl, paint white.
White.
White is best.
Paint white.
Just like white.
Thinking,
just
I'm actually white. Thinking like an off-white.
Should have worked
white
at a yeah. hospital.
Like a cream. Yeah. There you go.
I like everything.
Yeah, by the way, Lou, how many different colors of white are there now? It's
oh
insane.
My gosh. It's crazy. You know, the hot color right now is gray. Gray
yeah.
is big.
You don't want to go with the hot color, though, because then everyone will say, oh, you painted in 2017.
Well, but well, you know, the average person repaints every 3 years. And so, you know, the nice thing about paint is it's a great way to kind of freshen things up. And I'll tell you what, an accent wall in a really cool looking gray against a white other set of walls is really sharp.
Mm, I like that.
Three years.
Wow.
3 years?
It's yeah. a good one.
I don't think the average person is on
no,
that schedule.
That's not
they, right. They might talk about needing to repaint.
The average person is
for
yeah.
3 years
right now.
I've probably been talking about it for that long. She has, rather.
I don't think I've seen it for 10 years.
Do we have time for another?
Well,
quick,
well Sandberg has a question. Quickie. We don't want to miss that.
I do. Lou, yes. I wanted, there's a little debate in my household going on about the bathroom vent fan after a shower. Sometimes Pat and I, we have such different schedules. I'll come home from work and he will have been gone for 3 hours and the fan is still on.
It's a little long.
And I was, that's, I said, I think maybe you should turn it off before you leave, because if I don't get home for 3.5 hours, like, are we going to burn this thing out? And he
no.
said, well, then it doesn't dry. And so I'm right. curious if you could
it's
solve
good
that.
15, I mean, my recommendation is always a good 15 minutes
okay.
afterwards. But again, what happens is you get ready, you get dressed, and all of a sudden you walk out the door, you forget to do that. There are...
Yeah, I don't forget, but...
why did I not... why did I,
I mean, you knew that.
Anticipate that, yeah. But there are moisture switches that you can put on a fan that'll sense the moisture and it'll turn it off when it's appropriate.
Oh.
Then it's done. You turn it on. Once it senses the moisture levels down,
okay.
shuts it off.
That's interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, it comes in white.
Hey, Lou, a texter named Lave...
Lave?
Has a question? Yes.
Lave Lennett?
Yes. How'd you know? No, it's
he
not.
Works with Bondria.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'll hold this for next week.
Okay.
This can wait.
What, you just wanted to do the intro? What's the question?
All right. It was. I've got some standing water in my backyard after all the rain this week.
Mm.
And it's been suggested to me that I put in a French drain. Do I have to go all the way to France to get it?
Right. No, you don't. You can get that in Bannockburn. But... the problem with the French drain, it's a nice idea, but you got to go somewhere with it. In other words, you have to dig down.
Right in your neighbor's yard.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking.
Right, and you have to be careful that you don't affect the neighbors, because then it's all kinds of problems for neighbors and the village and the city. So the thing is, if you have a low spot in the lawn, what mm-hmm. I'd rather you do is actually add some topsoil to it and then reseed it if it's an area with grass.
Yes.
And just let the soil itself absorb it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will do
that's
that.
That's a good answer. What about your buckthorn, though? How's your buckthorn doing?
Lou, my buckthorn is exploding.
Yeah. Well, maybe that needs
I
a
I just
French
can't
drain.
Solve that problem. I mean, it's bad for my brand, but...
Maybe some drywall dust will kill it off.
Right.
What are you talking about on TV today?
We're talking about indoor air quality, you know, with this spring allergies. The biggest tip for those listening is... please upgrade your furnace filters. Stop with the pleated fiberglass. It doesn't do anything for indoor air quality. 10 times the filtering capabilities by just going with the inexpensive pleated filters. If you buy the fancy 3M ones, they're even better, and you can actually sleep easy at night as allergy season
starts.
Wait.
I think you sound like you just said two different things. Get the more expensive filters?
Correct. But my point is, if you don't, the big 3M ones are like $18, and people are like, he's crazy. I'm not spending $18. If you buy the cheap pleated filters, which are $5, as opposed to the cheap fiberglass, which are 99 cents.
Oh yeah, yeah, okay. So be sensible about
correct. It. Correct. You can for $5 or $6, 10 times the air filtering capabilities.
Got it. All right. Thanks, buddy.
Love you.
Love you back. That's great. The great and sometimes great Lou Manfredini. Good friends with Bondria and what was it? Lave.
That's right.
Lave.
Very good.
We're gonna come back talk China with an expert on China. Stand by for that as the president's meetings with the president of China continue today. But what are you doing in the big story next?
Syria. All about Syria and the repercussions right. today.
Update you on that in a moment on 720 WGN.
Back to the Steve Cochran Show.
I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator, which should have been done years ago. Any country that devalues their currency in order to take unfair advantage of the United States, which is many countries, will be met with sharply.
Michael Oslin writes about China and knows more about China than you and I and anybody else you know. And he joins us. We always like having Michael on the program, and obviously extremely appropriate this morning as the first summit between President Xi and President Trump will come to an end today. All this in the midst of what's going on overnight in Syria. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
You've made the point before that that President Trump's seeming, previously anyway, seeming lack of interest in the United States being a world power is a perfect opportunity for President Xi to step up, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you've written this before, bully Trump to kind of get a better foothold for China. Does that maintain truth this morning?
Well, you know, one strike is not going to change the geopolitical competition between the United States and China, but it will potentially change China's calculations about how they want to approach Trump. You know, they've gotten used to U.S. presidents, and not just Obama, but Bush before him and Clinton, who talked tough on China and then really did nothing when they themselves felt American interests were being impinged. Now you've got a guy that is living up to the fears that many people had that he's just entirely unpredictable, whether or not you support the Syria strikes. You know, this administration turned on a dime in about 48 hours. And that's going to factor into the Chinese calculations. And in some ways, it's not a bad thing. I think they've gotten a little too used to us being pretty predictable, that we would say a lot and not do many things. And those days may be over. Now, what that means after that is an open question.
So by the time this meeting ends today, what are both sides hoping to get out of it? And is Trump more of a follower or a leader in agenda on this?
Well, initially, I was convinced he'd be a follower in the agenda. You know, they don't have a full team into place. I thought they were rushing into the meeting. It was probably ill-advised to do this. You know, you don't need to do it in the first 2 months. Instead, figure out what you want to do about Asia. What do you want to do about China and trade, like the clip that you played leading into the segment? They haven't given us any of those indications. The Chinese, however, will always have a list of things that they want to do and try to get the U.S. to sort of fit into their perception of trade issues or political issues. So I was actually very worried. You know, the fact that President Trump was launching missiles while he's eating dinner with Xi Jinping, that sends a strong message to the Chinese that you're not going to be able to read necessarily what this guy is going to do. Now, if I were Trump, I'd follow up hard on this because you do have the concerns about North Korea. The administration has made some very strong statements about North Korea. The Chinese probably figured that it was just words again, but now you could say, look, we're willing to go and take some actions, and maybe even actions against your banks and companies that have been supporting the North Koreans unless you start working with us.
I want to come back to North Korea in a second, but Andrea, you remember what the president said when he was the candidate, right?
Yes, I do. Talked a lot. Go ahead.
No, you go.
Talked a lot about trade. I'm curious, Michael, do you think the trade restrictions now will be tougher between the United States and China going forward?
Well, that's really the big question, is whether they truly feel that the type of rhetoric they were using on the campaign makes sense, right? An across-the-board 45% tariff, it really doesn't make sense. You've seen a lot of moderation recently, and what they seem to be doing is instead looking more or talking about looking more at particular sectors. You know, this is exactly what we did with the Japanese back in the 1980s. We did sectoral reforms, and we've slapped sectoral tariffs on the Japanese. And in fact, then what the Japanese did, which is what many people expect the Chinese themselves to do in the coming months, is to proactively restrict imports on those sectors that we've identified where there's unfair trading practices, meaning it's not everywhere, but it may be in certain particular areas where they feel there's dumping or the currency valuation has a particular impact. So the Chinese, I think, are smart. That's what they'll probably do in order to forestall something bigger. The Trump administration then has to think, well, you know, what is the position that we want to take? Is there something in particular we want to get out of this? Would it be something on cyber or IPR, intellectual property rights? But the Chinese will probably try to forestall them, and they right now don't seem to have that overall plan of what they want to do.
So when he talked about currency manipulation, is that just a branded statement, or is that a real concern?
No, from him, it's actually a misstatement. It's a misinformation about what the Chinese are doing. He's come over again and again talking about the Chinese manipulating their currency. The fact is they are, but not in the way he thinks. They're doing it the opposite way. The Chinese currency is getting so weak that the Chinese are now manipulating it, intervening to prop it up. That's one reason they're not letting more capital flow out of the country. There's the Chinese economy is itself is dramatically weakening. There's a lot of a lack of confidence in that economy. And so what they're having to prop up in their currency, they're not artificially depressing it the way the president says. And actually what you've seen is that he himself continues to talk about that, but others around his circle have modified what they say about the currency. So I think he's using it, whether he fully understands it or not, he's using it in the political sense. The people actually working on this issue, I think, know that the Chinese are desperate to keep this currency from falling farther.
China almost never speaks up unless it's in their interest. Are they going to become a little louder now, or will they maintain we speak when we need to speak and we speak in our own interest?
Steve, China, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah.
China, will they continue to only speak when it concerns them and take whatever unilateral actions they like, or will they start to act like a superpower and weigh in on other things?
Yeah, look, I think, you know, this is a very different China from the one that we grew up with and, you know, got used to over the years, especially under this current leader, Xi Jinping. He is the most powerful leader China has seen, certainly since Deng Xiaoping 25 years ago, and maybe since Mao Zedong himself. He's got a lot of confidence. You saw that at Davos. You know, you saw him go out there, and even though no one really believed the words, he was talking about China basically being the defender of free trade and global trade around the world. This is a China that's much more confident, asserting its interests, talking about how it's going to be acting in the world, setting up institutions like an alternative infrastructure investment bank for Asia or an alternative free trade agreement after President Trump pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
World real estate is what it is. I just saw a story, Michael Oslin, that was amazing to me, that China, and obviously they have a lot of land, China is building a city larger than Manhattan, building it. Is real estate development still what goes on nonstop, you know, in China that we don't pay much attention to?
Yeah, not only is that happening, it's probably the biggest danger that they face. They have a massive property bubble, and that has fed into a huge debt bubble on the order of $20 trillion or more. It's a phenomenon called ghost cities that you've probably heard about. It's where they have decided in part because they want to ease the congestion in the major cities like Shanghai or Beijing, and they also don't want sort of unrestricted labor flowing into those cities, that they've been building these enormous cities for millions of people. Around the country, and no one goes to them because there's no jobs there. There's no industry around there. It's the problem with central planning. It makes perfect sense on paper to say we're going to build a huge city, and then you can't get people to go unless you forcibly relocate them, and that's not what China does. So if they're continuing to build, and I hadn't heard this, that they're building a city larger than Manhattan, if the Chinese bubble pops, if this property bubble and this debt bubble pop, it's going to be because of this unrestrained building, and it could be a catastrophic event for the Chinese economy, which is already weak.
It's Michael Oslin. Where do we follow you on Twitter and other places?
You can follow on Twitter at Michael Oslin on Twitter, or the webpage at my institute, which is www.aei.org, and then just my name, put that in there. That's pretty much the two best places to follow me.
And the most recent book is?
It's called The End of the Asian Century, War, Stagnation, and the Risks to the World's Most Dynamic Region.
Always appreciate you taking a difficult topic and boiling it down for us. And we didn't even get to Taiwan, which maybe is not a bad thing right now. But thank you, Michael.
You got enough on the plate.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate your time. Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, and Plumbing gives away season tickets. And we will have the season ticket winner for next season on the show this morning. Before we get to any of that, though, let's go over last night's game. with this, what do we call this, the Express?
The Blackhawks Express.
Yeah, it couldn't be more Express than this.
Hawks lose tonight 4-0 here in Anaheim.
There you go. That's the entire replay of last night, and I don't think we need to hear any more. So, is Ryan Hartman okay, by the way?
Yeah, I think he survived that slash. That was,
yeah.
It was
mugging
kinda,
by Corey Perry?
Yeah, it was an ugly game. I mean, kind of got kind of chippy. But he came back.
They're not cute ducks. They're mean ducks.
Mean, nasty ducks.
Mean,
like you
nasty.
You took their breadcrumbs away.
Ducks.
They're not happy.
Jerky ducks. Don Rickles. I will talk more about Don Rickles, you know, later on in the 7 o'clock hour. But I want to play something for you from last night. Jimmy Kimmel loved Rickles. And Jimmy Kimmel has a great respect for the comedy greats. He got emotional last night, as he often does, talking about these guys as they get older and pass away. The thing about Don was Don's 90. And I tweeted this out yesterday. I believe it to be true. You know, he just moved from Vegas to heaven. He just signed a new long-term deal in heaven. And while I feel for Barbara and Ed and Mindy and the family, this is a hell of a run by a really terrific guy. But Jimmy Kimmel encapsulated some of that last night on his show as he talked about Mr. Rickles.
The first time Don was on our show was almost 4 years after we started. We've been trying to book him since the beginning. We asked him to do the show over and over again, and he didn't know what this was. He knew the Tonight Show and Letterman, and that's it. But finally, after we bothered him like 20 times, he gave up, and he did the show for my birthday in 2006, and it was exciting. It was like I was in some kind of talk show host fantasy camp, sitting behind a desk while Don Rickles made fun of me. It was like, you know, being a real talk show host for a minute, so... But he was very sweet. They called him Mr. Warmth as a joke, but that was what he was. He would always ask about my parents, my kids. When my Uncle Frank passed away, I called him and asked him to be the guest on that show, which was a tough show. And he helped all of us through it. He gave me advice, and good advice, not the advice people give you just to hear themselves giving you advice. He would always say, keep my name alive, which he'd tell me to keep his name alive, which I thought was funny because, you know, I was like, you're Don Rickles. You keep my name alive.
It's a piece of Kimmel from last night. And Kimmel is that guy. Kimmel is that emotional. And Kimmel's a sweet guy. But Rickles was something else. And Andrea, I don't want to be dropping names here, so let me drop something else.
Okay.
I saw Don Rickles' junk. Yeah, it's true.
Wait, I'm sorry, his what?
His junk. Yeah, his
no.
junk.
Can we ask how this happened?
Yeah, Don Rickles was old school show business, and he would never wear his pants until he had to go on stage. So the pants would always be hung so they would, you know, so the crease would hold and they wouldn't be wrinkled.
Okay.
So Don would be backstage in a robe. And, you know, the handful of times I was backstage with Don Rickles, you almost always had to have someone else. Or a couple times I said, I go, Don, close him up there.
Right.
Close him up there, buddy.
Too much info right
too
there.
Too much info, Don. Yep, too much info.
You know what, though? What a fun memory. In more ways than one, but how great was that? He was so funny.
He insulted me, and anybody who has ever spent a minute on stage doing comedy, if you've ever been insulted by Don Rickles, you've arrived in some form.
Yes, you
Does
have.
Does that mean he likes you?
Yes, you have.
Yes. And he really was a nice guy. So, more on that later. Before we get to any of it, let's take one more break. Come back with a 7 o'clock hour. That'll be next everywhere on 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Show me.
All right, 7:14. Andre, I've got a little headphone problem here.
You bet, yeah. You okay? You sound good singing this song.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you,
yes.
Steve. You sound good.
Yeah, I've
good.
Got a little headphone problem. Somebody unplugged my headphones.
Uh-oh.
And you know me, I'm just another pretty face. I don't know how to plug these things back in.
Man.
There we go. Now we're good.
Yeah, there you are.
Excellent. Pamela Flanagan and Daniel O'Leary are here. Daniel O'Leary, managing director, and Pamela Flanagan. Can I say this? I think I can. Badass polo player. How about that?
Yeah. That's what we've been calling her, Steve.
Yeah, and nice to have both of you on the program. Frankly, we needed a break from all the hard news of the day, and I'm glad you guys are here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so, Daniel, not that you're not desperately interesting, but because I want to get to you in just a second.
He is.
But before we do that, and before we talk polo, Pamela, when do you sleep? Because I'm looking at a list here. Designer, lawyer, polo player, model, nuclear physicist,
CIA. I fit it in when I have time, which isn't often.
A lot of energy, huh?
I guess so. I have to. A lot of coffee, at least.
And you're a kid that grew up in Barrington.
Mm-hmm.
When were you exposed to polo?
I went to a boarding school called Culver Academies. It's in Culver, Indiana. It's not too far from here, actually. And okay. They have an incredible horse program there. So I started playing when I was about 15, my sophomore year there, with Tom Goodspeed, one of the best coaches in the game, really. And I was just really fortunate to have a great program at a great school with a great coach, and I just got hooked right away.
This seems to me to be an essential question about the sport. What is more important, the rider or the horse?
Ooh, very good question. The horse is incredibly important. You can't play a good game without a good horse, without several good horses, in fact. But at the same time, you have to be a good rider and a good player. It's about 70% the horse, I'd say.
You know, Daniel, I was exposed to polo with all the gross generalizations that everybody has. Oh, yeah, the rich guy sport. Isn't that cute how they're riding around whacking a little ball? These guys are unbelievable athletes.
They are. I came from mainstream sports, and that's one of the things that got me hooked on the sport is that these athletes are, you know, in the same ranks as other stick and ball sports, whether it be, or stick and puck, you know, like Patrick Kane or Rizzo or any of these guys. Probably some of the most incredible athletes I've ever seen on a horseback running 35 miles per hour with a mallet that's 55 inches long, hitting a ball the size of a baseball from, 5 feet high on a mounted horse. So
yeah,
it's
and
trying
not to run into the other horsey and fall off your horsey. Andre, have you ever seen polo live?
I have seen one time. I actually covered a story for Channel 9 at the Oprah Polo Club, and it's a beautiful, beautiful. Do you call it an arena or just an area? What do you call the grounds, I guess it would be?
The field, the pitch.
It's so beautiful. I was always wondering how you maintain it and where you practice. Because, you can go to any basketball court or tennis court and practice your game, ice rink, but where do you go and practice?
Yeah, there's no YMCA for polo.
Exactly, yeah.
In Chicago or Chicagoland, there's probably about 10 different clubs that have polo fields. There's Oak Brook, there's Armour, there's Due West, Morgan Creek, Font Farm, and they all have one or two polo fields where people practice during the week, on the weekends, and so on and so forth. And they'll also have league or tournament play as well. So it's happening all over the place. And the field conditions are incredibly important for the safety of the sport. So even if it has a heavy rain overnight, practice can get canceled the next day due to the footing and things like that. So always kind of up in the air in terms of when things are practiced. And typically the best times to practice or the place to practice are not necessarily the field but an arena. There is Polo Arena, which is 3-on-3 instead of 4-on-4, which typically takes place indoor. So that's usually if the outdoor field conditions are not going well, we'll bring it inside.
Now, golfers are very into their clubs, obviously, and the golf ball that they use. Where do you get a good polo mallet? And
the mallet hut at the mall.
How do you decide?
That's actually really important. You have to go. There's so
mallets.
Many different factors.
Just mallets. Where do you have to go?
In Argentina, they've got great mallets, but they've also have a few manufacturers here in the States, most of them in Wellington, Florida. So it's interesting because you can go down there and you get your perfect mallet, and they take all of your stats and they have, all of your everything you need, your grip size, your weight, the flex that you want. And then you just call them up and say, send me 10 more. And then you send 10 back to get fixed. And you just kind of have a record of what you like. And they get to know you as a player, and they send you your custom mallets.
They have to be standard color, though? I mean, you can't have, pink or
have pink.
Okay, good. That's what I thought.
So you can design it up. You can customize it for you.
Cool. Definitely. Your initials, whatever you want.
How dangerous is it? Have you ever been badly hurt?
I actually had a really bad accident last November, but fortunately I wasn't hurt. It is a pretty dangerous sport. You can imagine being on an animal like a horse going 30 miles an hour, running into other horses, stopping, turning. It's very dangerous. Fortunately, people don't get hurt that often, but it does happen, certainly.
And the strategy of the sport, for instance, outdoor polo, how do you know who's on the attack and who's staying back to defend?
You know, you have players 1 through 4. On the field, there's 4 players on each team, and in the arena, there's 3. And the first player, number 1, kind of acts as a wide receiver. You know, he's a forward. Number 2, more of like a wide receiver / running back. 3 is like a quarterback, and 4 is kind of a defensive player. So, you know, you decide before the game, of course, and make a strategy with your team who plays what position, and that's you kind of go forward from there.
And what's your position?
Ooh, it depends on who I'm playing with. Depends on who you're playing with, because teams are constantly switching up. So it depends on the experience of the other players. If I'm playing with, you know, professionals from Argentina, I'm going to play up and let them do all the hard work and just pass it up to me. If I'm playing in a women's tournament with a bunch of girls that just started, then I'll probably sit back a little bit and play a little further back. So your position changes depending on who you're playing with.
It might be a crazy question, but do you use the same horse? I mean, you have to probably train with your horse, right? So he or she knows your moves and where you're going. And
ideally, yes. Okay. But you change horses every chucker, and sometimes a couple horses per chucker. And there's anywhere between
Andrea,
4
you change every chucker.
I know. I forgot about the chuckers.
Yeah. So you need a whole string of horses. You need several
Dave, you
got
to watch your chuckers.
I know that. I always try to.
Just to kind of give you a perspective of numbers, you know, the high goal season, which takes place in Wellington, Florida right now, which was 26 goal or above, those teams have 40 horses per team.
Oh, wow.
Each player is using about 10 horses per game. And so are constantly swapping out like you do in hockey.
Yeah.
You know, you can remount at any time during the game. So people are remounting on their ponies and running back right onto the field.
Isn't that like using somebody else's skates, though, or someone else's stick? I mean, once you kind of get into a groove with the animal, isn't it the challenge?
Definitely, it's challenging. And that's what I'm doing this weekend, actually. I fly out tomorrow for a tournament in Florida, and I'm renting horses I've never ridden before. So you just got to jump on. You've got about 30 seconds to figure it out, and you go.
Now, I'm going to make an assumption here, because I was surprised at the co-ed cooperation at high speed. That it doesn't matter if you're male or female, it matters how good you are. Is that true?
That is true, yes.
Well, that's unique to sport. I mean, you guys should be proud of that.
Absolutely. I mean, I love it, honestly. You can play with guys. Here's the thing. You can play, every girl can play in every guy's tournament, but guys can't play in the women's tournament. So it's kind of nice, actually. You can pick and choose.
No, that seems fair. Now, so you're not exposed to the same sort of sexism you might be exposed to in other sports.
Not at all. I mean, there's some of that, sure, especially when you've got Pink Mountain, Pink Helmet running around on the field with all boys. But, you know, they get over it real quick when they see you can play.
The opening day is coming up. Daniel, tell me where and when.
Yeah, so our opening day is June 11th, Chicago Polo Day at the Oak Brook Polo Grounds, which is at 2606 York Road in Oak Brook, Illinois. Tickets went on sale earlier this month. You can get them at www.oakbrookpoloclub.com. We have 7 events this season, 3 of which are International Polo Series, so we'll be having teams from Jamaica, India, and Great Britain.
Wow, cool. Very cool.
Very cool.
Well, it's exciting. It's fun. I hope people come out in big numbers, because it's very cool to watch, and you don't really appreciate it, in my opinion, unless you see it live. Mm-hmm. So where do we follow you guys? Social media-wise, website-wise.
You can follow Oak Brook Polo Club on Facebook, Instagram, as well as on LinkedIn and Twitter. So our handles are OB Polo Club or Oak Brook Polo. Oak Brook Polo.
All right. How about you, Pam?
My Instagram is Pamela_Alina, so you can see all my polo stuff there.
All right, cool. Great to meet you guys, and have a great season.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, and Dave, you know this, but, you know, I actually, when, you know, the horses weren't ready, I would actually give the team members piggyback rides.
I know.
And then, you know, just run around the field.
Yeah. That's not, it actually worked okay for a while, Steve, but then you didn't walk very well after that.
Well, a couple of the guys hit me in the head with a mallet, you know, and frankly, I couldn't take it.
It added a lot to the sport, though. You got
it. Very visual. Visual. Hawks season ticket winner coming up. Traffic, Mary.
The Steve Cochran Show.
Woo! Woo! What are we celebrating?
It's Friday.
Well, there's that. But how about season tickets for next year for the Blackhawks?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. That'd be awesome, Steve. Yeah.
Cool. Well, not for you guys. No, not for you guys.
Man.
No, season tickets for the winner. I'm standing by on the phone right now. Dave, what can you tell me about this winner?
Well, now that the Blackhawks have played their last regular season home game, all season long we gave it the chance to win a pair of tickets to every Blackhawks home game thanks to Four Seasons Heating, Air Conditioning, and Plumbing. Everybody who won those tickets was eligible for the chance to win four season tickets for the Blackhawks 2017-2018 campaign.
But not everybody can win, Dave.
Not everybody can win.
You can only have one winner.
And guess who that winner is?
I bet he's on the phone right now.
He is, and he is James Renick of Chicago.
James Renick! James, how come we sound more excited than you?
Oh, I'm very excited. Very excited.
This is amazing, James. You have season tickets for next year. Every game.
It blows my mind. I told my sister about it, and I already have second cousins coming out of the woodwork, like telling me, oh, set aside this game, set aside this game.
I'll bet. Let's see how they behave now.
Exactly. Huh?
Steve, does James know that he can take different people to every game? And I'm usually free Fridays and Saturday nights. Just a
yeah. Right, oh, right.
Yeah. I got to set up a ledger, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to need a spreadsheet, my friend. But we want to thank the people at Four Seasons. What's the – now, I assume you're a Hawks fan, have been for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Missouri, so I grew up a Blues fan, but, you know, my cousins want to come up for that game too.
You finally came around. Good for you.
Yeah.
But what's the most Hawks games you'd ever been to previously in a season?
I went to two this past year, and that's it, because it's not
two?
Cheap.
How about 40 or 50? You up for that?
Yeah, I'm definitely up for that, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Well, that's what it's going to be. Congratulations, man. I'm glad you're excited. And who's going to go with you most of the time?
I imagine my girlfriend, probably.
Good call by you.
Sorry, AD.
It's okay. There's a lot of games out there, James. I'm fine with that.
I know.
Yeah. Well, we're very excited. What do you do?
Well, I'm a bookkeeper for a little real estate company.
How's business?
Business is fine, but I've got my nights free.
You want to plug the company?
No, I'd rather not.
Okay. All right. So obviously you're involved in something illegal. But that's okay. As long as you have time to enjoy the hockey. So congratulations, buddy. We're very excited for you, and we appreciate that you're listening. And I know you want to thank everybody at Four Seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you guys so much. It's the best prize I've ever won.
Yep. Stand by, bud. Hold on.
Awesome.
Is James on hold?
Yeah, he's on hold now. You want to talk about him?
Oh, this is funny. It always amuses me when people don't want to mention where they work.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. Hey, no.
Maybe because they're supposed to be working and they don't want them to think, oh, I'm listening to the Steve Cochran show and winning season Hawks tickets.
Yeah, well, the way he disguised his voice, I'm sure they wouldn't figure it out.
And right. By the way, we want to thank Four Seasons. I know you just did, Steve, for all the right reasons. Four Seasons. Find them online at foursseasonsheatingcooling.com or on Facebook.
Memories of Don Rickles coming up. Stand by for that. We'll do the big story first on 720 WGN.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
I really have never on the stage, anything I've ever done, I've never taken back. In the sense that when I stand out there, you have to believe in what you do. If for one moment you say, oh, I shouldn't have said that, you're a fool. As an entertainer, this is in my own opinion and what I do. When I'm out there, I'm doing my best to make people laugh. And I'm doing, with all earnesty, I'm not out there to hurt somebody. If it comes off that way, I'm sorry in my heart, but I never take it back. In other words, I perform with my soul and with my honesty, and I think that's what makes me go.
The great Don Rickles died yesterday, 90 years old, kidney failure after really long illnesses. Kind of age-appropriate illnesses, I suppose. But, man, what a run. What a run. And truly one of the greats. A guy who tried to do the traditional stand-up act. And one day at a particular club, threw out a few insults, and the rest was history. There are those of the comedy historian types who will say there were other insult comics in the 30s and 40s and 50s, you know, vaudeville and all the way through. But nobody was ever Don Rickles, and nobody ever will be.
Do you remember, Steve, Linda Carter did the 7-Up commercial with him back in the day? She posted a really, really adorable picture of the two of them from that ad saying, R.I.P. Don Rickles, love you so much. But it brings back just hilarious memories of him.
Well, the thing is, if you ever got a chance to meet him, and I was lucky enough to get to know him a little bit, he was an incredibly sweet guy. And I think as much as anything, as a matter of fact, I know this because we had conversations about it. He wanted people to know that. And a little bit of that intro spoke to that. But he never tried to hurt people's feelings. He never went up on stage and popped people and then said, yeah, good, you had it coming. He was really a sensitive guy. And for those of you who may have heard before the top of the hour, played the Jimmy Kimmel tribute. What Kimmel said is true, too. He always asked you about your family. He always asked how you were doing. And when I was just a child of 24 or 25, I was in Baltimore on the radio. I'm minding my own business. I'm not hurting anybody. And I was doing a little stand-up, and the guy that ran the local Baltimore comedy club knew a promoter in Atlantic City. So the promoter in Atlantic City calls and says, hey, Rickles' opener canceled. I got to get somebody. And this comedy club owner goes, I got a kid here. I don't know if he can make it. And of course, rightfully, the guy in Atlantic City goes, what do we need a kid from Baltimore for? You know, I got New York there. I got Philadelphia there. So I hop on a train. I make it to Jersey, to Atlantic City. And I'm going to open for Don Rickles. Now, I was nervous. There's nerve. Remember broadcast news? Remember the flop sweat?
Oh, yeah.
So that's the kind of thing I was feeling. And Don Rickles could not have been nicer. Could not have been better. And I go out and I do a couple of jokes. And I can't imagine how lame they must have been. And I hit sort of a flat spot in my big five-minute set. And Rickles walks out. He walks out because he knows I'm going to die in front of him. And he walks out on stage. The place goes nuts, obviously. And he stands there, and he gives me the ultimate honor. And I was lucky. He did this for me a couple of times, but he insulted me in front of a giant crowd. And as a comedian or anybody who pretends to be, being insulted by Don Rickles is pretty cool. Afterwards, he gave me a few tips, a couple of things to think about, and here's how cool he was. He said, I'm going to be in Detroit. I don't know if you could do that, but I'm going to be here. Anyway, I ended up opening for him two or three or four or five different times. So a few years go by, and there's a friend of mine in Los Angeles named Ed Mann. And Ed, really good musician and a better businessman. And Ed said, you're not going to believe who I'm dating. And I said, well, who's that? Mindy Rickles. Well, Mindy is Don's daughter. So they end up getting married, and Ed invites us to the wedding. And I am sitting at the wedding with Bob Newhart. And we're sitting there with Bob Newhart and Bob Newhart's family. And Bob Newhart is as nice a guy as you would imagine and as good a guy as you would imagine. In his tribute yesterday to his best friend, Don, would just break your heart. He said, you can't believe how sad this is. None of us were expecting this. And you would think, well, you know, he had a good run and he was sick, but nobody wanted Don to go. Nobody wanted Don to leave. Mm-hmm. So I feel for Ed, I feel for Mindy, I feel for Nathan and Harrison, their kids, Don's grandkids, and obviously for Barbara. Don's only son, Larry, died back in 2011 after, an illness. But he was very much a family guy. And, for him to achieve what he achieved in comedy over the course of time that he was on, and I would put him up, as a matter of fact, I don't think there's any question, the greatest talk show guest in late-night TV history. We're going to play you some clips to back that claim up. But I'm here to tell you, he could not have been a sweeter guy and a nicer guy. And I texted Ed yesterday and talked a bit, and I'm just feeling for them, too. So the country loses Don Rickles, but for Ed and Mindy and the family, they lose their father, their grandfather, their father-in-law. And that's a big deal, and Bob Newhart loses his best friend. So that part is sad. But at 90, what a run.
Big time.
What a run. And I want to play some clips for you, so let's do this. Let's do traffic, and then we'll come back, and we'll play you some Rickles from Carson and Rickles from Letterman and Rickles from some of the best late-night stuff of Don Rickles coming up on 720 WGN. I'm thinking of Tom Dreesen today, too. You know, Tom Dreesen is like kind of a walk-and-talking comedian's history book because – worked with him. So I got to connect with him later as well. Oh, and speaking of comedians, our friend John DeCosta, it's his birthday today.
Yeah, happy birthday to John.
Happy birthday,
musical
John.
Musical director for this program.
We'll celebrate next week, or week after?
We'll probably celebrate next week. We're trying to reach John, actually. But he's not taking our call. I think he's working with Eric and Kathy and Steve Harvey this morning.
He's working on our big comedy show tomorrow night.
So... there's that, sure, absolutely.
Oh, you could have a cake for him tomorrow.
Yeah, I was trying to convince Mary.
Happy birthday
I told him if he would have come in today, I would have made him a cake, but yeah. He was really sneaky about his birthday plans.
I told Mary she has to make one of those Portillo's chocolate cake, the better than Portillo's chocolate cake that she makes, and we could bring it to him on stage Saturday.
I believe.
Kind of forgot.
Yeah, when are you going to need you to get a couple of those done, Mary? Yeah. I believe John turns 58 today, and I think he treats 58 like I treat 56. It was like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
That's what it says on the Facebook, 58.
Yeah, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. All right, let me play you some of this Don Rickles. Don Rickles was very good friends with Frank Sinatra. The two people that really helped make Rickles were Sinatra and Johnny Carson. And even though he was almost 40 when he really hit, he did 100 Carsons and one of the greats, to do walk-ons on Carson, including when he walked out and surprised Frank.
I just was hanging around in the hall, and they said, Frank Sinatra's here, and I've never met him, you know. And I get the chill.
You'll excuse us, won't you?
Certainly, certainly. Marco Mangananzo was hurt.
Ooh. Marco Mangananzo?
Fombino Bombazzo. Two bullets in the head Thursday. Now, this you don't believe. Excuse us, Johnny. You're from the Midwest. You're busy going, is the truck loaded? Guido says hi. He hasn't had a chance to talk to you. And from Jersey City, your good friend, Bubani Umbatsa.
What's his alias?
He started his car. He started his car with your album on, and now he's a highway.
That's Rickles updating Frank on the mob. Rickles with Frank with one of the most famous Rickles stories ever. Listen.
Listen, can I tell a story about what this man did to me once? You may have known or heard about this. It was a true story. This is a long time ago, long before Don got married. I was eating dinner in a restaurant in New York, and I was sitting with some friends, and he came over to the table, and he said, Frank, do me a favor, will you? He said, I'm sitting with a very pretty girl, and I'm trying to make out, you know. And he said, I told her I know you, and she really doesn't believe me. Would you stop by the table? I said, all right. I was just about finished. I was down to the espresso. And finally, he went back, and I walked by the table, and I said, how are you, Don? Nice to see you. He said, can't you see I'm eating, Frank? What are you doing?
Rickles and Letterman were very close friends as well through the years, and Letterman was one of the few people that actually leave and go out and have dinner in public with Rickles, which was a great sign of respect. Here's Rickles on Letterman back in the early 80s.
You're like Carson, the real Midwest guy. He never perspires. I bet when you get married, you make love to the wife. Not a trickle. Nothing. I bet you probably stand by the end of the bed going, well, I want to take a crack at it, huh? What do you say? Anyway. I could say anything because at 12:30, nobody's up.
No. There's a fine group of folks out
no,
there.
No, you have a good
this.
Following. I never thought you were going to make it. I'm delighted for you. I was one of the guys that said, this guy's a stiff, he ain't going to make it.
No.
And Crystal, that kid Crystal, Billy Crystal.
Billy Crystal.
Yeah, who's your good friends, like Newhart and I. You are good friends.
Yeah, he's a very funny man.
Yeah, he is. Because I watched him on the show, and I spoke to him a few times about you, and he was fed up, too. No, that's not true.
It's a thing that he repeated again and again and again on late night TV. And to see some of the funniest people in the world laughing that hard because Don Rickles was making them laugh was always cool. Here's a clip from Jon Stewart on The Daily Show back in 2008 with Rickles.
I have not seen you since the Emmy Awards, not a couple of months ago, where you defeated me and Stephen Colbert.
Absolutely. You were weak. You and Stephen couldn't make it. I'm a guy that I'm not a kid anymore. And I just rolled right through with the award. And when I went home, I said to the wife, I beat that Jon Stewart. That
and, You gloated? You gloated at home
yeah,
over my defeat.
And we're married 43 years and I wanted to make a move. And she said, cancel it. Hey, you're too big. See, when Jews make love, we circle the bed and get an estimate.
And finally, a clip from Rickles on his last interview with Johnny. Again, 100 times plus on the Tonight Show. Here's Rickles' last interview on the old Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
I was going to talk to you when you were back in Pittsburgh because I picked up the paper one day and it showed the 10 best dressed men in the United States, or the 10th in the world. And the tailors or the fashion people voted you as one of the 10 best dressed people.
That is correct.
With this body. I mean, how... How'd you get on that list?
Don't turn on me.
Don't turn on me. It's not advisable.
Is that true? The 10 best?
Well, that's what they say. Look at Ed. Emmett Kelly dresses better than him. No, you dress. You dress nice, but you don't know about clothes. You're from Nebraska.
What are you talking about?
You have eight guys say, that looks good, Johnny. You go, honest to God? You don't know about clothes. If they left it up to you, you'd wear those checkered shirts with the thing over the ears going, let's get some deer. I saw your lovely wife, Alex, in Pittsburgh.
She told me you were back there.
You talk about marriage. There's a guy in your band. How long have you had that?
Well, I just started.
Get on the Jerry Lewis telethon.
All right. She said you were back. Let me get something.
Well, jump in. You're the host. You're acting so secure since you're leaving, for crying out loud. And the other guy's at home working on his chin.
Look.
The final, Johnny Carson. And you can find endless clips on YouTube. And if you love Rickles, I hope you do. Rest in peace, Don. And thanks for everything that you did for everybody in the comedy business. And thanks for always being so nice to me. 7:59, back after this with the news next on 720 WGN.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Dean Richards joins us from Channel 9.
Citizens of the world.
Some of the world's greatest entertainers are here tonight.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you.
And tonight, guess what? It's going to be Dean.
Yeah, Hollywood. You know I love you more than when I should. Yeah, Hollywood. Well, kiss me, kiss me good.
Live from Channel 9. And don't forget CLTV hour, 9 o'clock this morning.
It's the best hour of any television station in the world.
I think so. Yeah, I couldn't argue with that. I mean, you're smart. The CLTV folks joined us at 9. Dean Richards is live at Channel 9. How are things there this morning?
Oh, it's melancholy, honestly. Since yesterday, since the news that Don Rickles passed away, we go into... sort of like emergency news mode. We need to, put together the stories and find the right tributes and so forth. And I'm sad because I was such a big Don Rickles fan. And I'm sitting here watching these clips, writing somebody's obituary, laughing my head off.
That's the way it should be.
Laughing my head off.
That's the way it should be, and that's the way he wanted it. That's exactly right. He would like you to laugh and point. All right, so we'll get to Rickles. We played you some sound last hour, but Dean's got a couple other clips I want to get to as well. But let's do this first. You got movies you want to just dispatch with?
Nothing special new at the movies this weekend. There's this new movie that is a remake of the old George Burns, Art Carney, and Lee Strasberg film.
Going in style.
The old version from 1979. Three seniors, rob a bank just for the fun of it. This new one, God bless you, is...
trying to hide it as much as possible.
was that you?
It sounded like it came
from across the room.
It's actually a cough. I'm trying to cover it up as much as possible.
I still have one, too. This is a new version that's Morgan Freeman, Michael Caine, Alan Arkin. Three seniors who decide to rob a bank because they've lost their pensions. Because of corporate shenanigans, mergers, all the financial stuff that's going on now. So they decide to get even with the bank by doing a bank robbery. You've seen these, seniors doing naughty things, seniors, trying to do things that they could do when they were younger that are not so easy to do now. About 20 times before. It's really nothing new. It's really nothing special. Maybe one of the biggest wastes of talent.
Yeah, just ignore that.
In a movie that I've ever seen with these, you got three Oscar winners heading up this movie that is nothing special. You've got Anne Margaret in this movie, a little supporting role. Kenan Thompson from SNL is in it. Just a whole lot of nothing special. So Dean's List C-minus on that one. And Steve, you'll be disappointed to know that I did not screen the new Smurfs movie, Smurfs Lost Village.
You claim you didn't screen it.
Yeah.
I believe you've probably seen it three or four times.
And I just don't want to admit it?
Probably. All right.
All right. I'm busted.
All right. And before
you got
we take
me.
A break.
Big
and
fan
come
of
back.
Papa Smurf, so you're on your own with that one. Before this is also my nickname for Steve, by the way.
Before we take the break and come back and talk a little more, Rickles, we note with sadness this morning the Green Bay Packers quarterback Aaron Rodgers has broken up with sexy actress Olivia Munn.
Oh, no. I hadn't heard that.
Now, you as real estate agent of the Stars, I know you had a listing that they were looking at. What does that do for your business?
Well, that hurts me. But, Steve, you know, it's funny that you should mention my side real estate business that I've got of selling celebrity homes. Because are you at Northwestern Hospital this morning?
No,
don't make him laugh, Dean. Don't do it.
A little pulmonary embolism thing.
Wow.
I'll be over it one day.
I'm going to get you an iron lung over the weekend.
Yeah.
Steve, I know you've been looking for a New York place. Greta Garbo's New York apartment has just come up.
Is that the studio?
Just got the listing on this. This is a New York co-op. It overlooks the East River. And it's in a building with 16 apartments, got a swimming pool. It's on a quiet cul-de-sac, 2,800 square foot apartment.
Sounds perfect for me.
It's the entire fifth floor, and still has much of Greta Garbo's original decor. Steve, I can get you this, honey, for $5.9 million.
I've got...
Good deal.
$208 in my wallet right now. Well, will you take $208?
I'll be happy to put in an offer for you. I can't guarantee anything's going to happen.
Tell them about my cough.
I was going to mention, it's on a quiet cul-de-sac until you move in.
Right.
And then suddenly it becomes the whooping cough ward.
Yeah, tell them if they don't take my deal, I'll spread whatever I have, even though it's not contagious.
Steve, I have an extra $6.50 in my pocket. Actually, no, $6, so you can throw that in,
too. We're up to $214.
You start collecting some funds, and I think we can get a little closer and make this charming place your home.
Greta Garbo's original decor, from what decade would that be?
Let me see if I have that info. I have not actually been in contact with Ms. Garbo herself. Well, it says original decor such as Fortuny silk on the walls.
What kind of silk?
Fortuny.
Yeah, my favorite.
Fortuny.
I'm going to ask a serious question, and I don't know the answer to this, but if
she's
something...
Dead.
Yes, we're aware of that. If something from the 30s or 40s decor-wise is still there, doesn't it maintain a certain odoriferous nature of the 30s and 40s?
I would think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would think that would be the case.
I would think that'd be a drawback.
It also could be super creepy, you know, very Sunset Boulevard-y looking, which, you know, hey, some people like that. Some people want that.
I'm going to drop my offer to $180 and keep the 20 for gas.
Again, I'll be happy to put the offer in. They are asking $5.9 million. Again,
I don't think we're that far apart.
Large living room, working fireplace, formal dining room, library, kitchen that includes locking silver and wine cabinets and breakfast area overlooking the river. Three bedrooms, three baths, a home office, custom desk, built-in, and a laundry utility room. I don't see a Greta Garbo doing her own laundry.
I would have think, when Greta Garbo, no, not now, for sure. When Greta Garbo was a star, didn't she have someone to beat her clothes on a rock?
Joan Crawford. Oh, wait, that was just beating. Sorry.
Yes, that was a different show.
Way to bring in Feud, though.
My
favorite show right now.
A19, let's do this. Traffic from Mary, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about Don Rickles. Because it's more fun than talking about Syria and China and North Korea and other things.
Greta Garbo.
Back after this with that on 720 WGN.
You'll be calling his name. Oh, 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 oh. Dean Richard, the entertainment editor. Channel 9 at 720. Oh, 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 oh,
oh, oh, oh, oh, oh. Back with Dean. A couple more clips to play in memory and remembering Don Rickles. And
did you hear any of Jimmy Kimmel from last night?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you to play. Play a little bit of Jimmy Kimmel's
It's great because he dedicated his entire monologue to Don Rickles and really super emotional during it.
Thank you for coming. It's not going to be our usual show tonight because, and I'm going to tell you right in front, I'm going to cry. I'm already crying, which is embarrassing, but... well, I'm not good with this sort of thing, and I'm sorry, especially to those of you who came to see the show in person, but because it's probably not what you came for, but we lost someone that we and I love very much today. And again, I'm sorry for hearing this just now for the first time, but Don Rickles passed away this morning, and he was 90 years old, and I know it sounds crazy to say he was too young, but he was, because he was... youthful and funny and sharp and generous.
Don't be a dumbbell.
Rarely does anyone get a standing ovation on this show.
Okay, that's it for me.
This is the 8th appearance you've made on this show.
I'll drop my pants and fire a rocket.
He was nothing but fantastic. And Dean, I mentioned last hour in the years that I knew him, always incredibly nice, always incredibly sweet to me, and very supportive of me.
Same with me.
Couldn't be better. But I was really touched, too, by Bob Newhart's statement.
Yeah.
And was there audio of that, or was that just a written statement?
Well, he issued a written statement last night after the passing, which was really sweet, in which he said that he and Jenny, his wife, and you have to remember that Don Rickles and his wife Barbara, Bob Newhart and his wife Jenny, were literally the best of friends. They were as close.
Traveled all over the world
as
together.
As friend as there can be, vacationed all the time together. Bob Newhart issuing a statement last night saying he was called the merchant of venom, but in truth he was one of the kindest, most caring, most sensitive human beings we've ever known. We're devastated. Our world will never be the same. We were totally unprepared for this. I want to say it might have been nine months ago, something. I interviewed Bob Newhart. I went out to Los Angeles, and we're talking about the Johnny Carson, and the launch of Johnny Carson on Antenna TV. But we, also talked about this odd couple friendship that Bob Newhart and Don Rickles had, and Newhart, explained it to us a little bit.
Yeah, we enjoy each other. I guess we're such opposites. I get that all the time. People say, how can you and Rickles? They always say, just how can you? Could you go on vacation with them? And I say, well, I don't listen to it. I just go crazy.
So, that's the key to a great friendship, marriage. I don't know. Just don't pay attention to the
other.
But
the thing is, and this because you spent some time with Don Rickles. Don Rickles on stage and Don Rickles backstage were two different guys.
No, he was.
He turned it up on stage and he turned it up on TV.
Yep.
But he was an incredibly nice guy. And his son-in-law told me many times, he bordered on boring. he was just a nice family guy who would come home after a week in Vegas and fall asleep in his chair the way a grandfather ought to.
Right.
And a good dude. And I could totally see Newhart and him hanging out. And how funny would it be just to follow them around on a trip?
Oh, my gosh. I have a picture that Bob Newhart showed me. When I interviewed him from that clip that I just showed him, it just was Bob's birthday. And, I wished him happy birthday, and he showed me, he said, I want to show you this picture. And it's him and Rickles and their wives at a restaurant in the Los Angeles area. They had just had a birthday dinner. They celebrated Bob's birthday. Had a little cake in front of Bob, small little cake with one candle in it. And here are these two lions of comedy sitting
big
there.
Big as it gets.
As big as it gets. As absolutely as big as it gets. These two guys, when you look at the picture, it's like, there's a couple of old guys sitting there having, a little piece of cake together. It's cute. And then, you think about what they meant to each other and their friendship and their love for each other. And it's like, this is the sweetest picture I've ever seen in my life of these two guys just, sitting there waiting to, blow out the candle and have a piece of cake. Really sweet, really lovely.
A great story from just a few years ago. There is, I'm going to forget the name of the brunch place. There's a brunch place in Malibu that Don liked to go to. And who Larry Ellison is? He's a big software guy, multi-billionaire, one of the richest guys in the world.
Yeah.
Larry's there, and Larry is probably 75, and he's there with his latest 25-year-old girlfriend. So Rickles is sitting there with Newhart and his son-in-law, Ed Mann, a buddy of mine. And as Ed tells the story, Rickles gets this little sparkle in his eyes. And he goes, hey, who's that guy? And Newhart goes, I don't know. And Ed goes, well, that's Larry Ellison. He started whatever the company is, and frankly, I'm forgetting the guy. Oracle. He was the guy that started Oracle, I think. And he goes, let's come here, help me over there, because Don's legs were bad. So Ed helps him stand up. So Don's walking over. Bob sort of waddles behind him, and Ed's standing up there. And he goes up to Larry Ellison and goes, Larry, you're not even going to say hi? And he gives him a hug. Larry Ellison has barely met him. But now Larry Ellison feels like a big guy because Don Rickles is hugging him. And he looks at Larry, and he looks at the girl, and he looks at Larry, and he looks at the girl, and he goes, Larry, with all your money, you couldn't make one that was a little older? They walked to the car, and he and Newhart high-fived each other, like a couple of 12-year-olds.
That's so funny. That's so sweet.
You got the montage. I wanted to play this. This is a collection you put together.
It's just a little, yeah, it's a little bit of Don Rickles on David Letterman with Howard Stern. It's a little bit of Don Rickles at one of those Dean Martin celebrity roasts. And a little bit of Don Rickles, 1985, at President Ronald Reagan's inaugural ball.
Good evening, Mr. President. Nice to see you, sir. And your lovely wife, Nancy. It's a big treat for me to fly all the way from California to be here for this kind of money. I make fun of the president. Why not? I make fun of everybody in the world. That's America. Laughing, Charlton Heston. I'm a friend. It's over. I'll tell you this. If you were Moses, I was a Mau Mau fighter pilot. Elizabeth Taylor was backstage in a Cleopatra outfit killing snakes. I'll tell you this. It is a, without question, in fairness to Mr. Dean Martin, this has been one of the longest evenings I've ever spent in my life. Except for the drunk. It was just charming. I know the hour is late. The dinner was absolutely fantastic, I must say that. A bowl of peanuts and water with a guppy in it.
I don't live under a rock. I know who Jack Hanner is, but
he acts like you don't know what's going on.
You know who handled Jack Hanner? Look at we're making him famous all of a sudden.
Right.
Jack Hanner, when Johnny Carson rest his soul,
right.
used to work with the animals.
Mm-hmm.
He worked great with him. Then I watched you work with the animals.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you,
wait a minute. It's the animals. I got nothing to do with it.
No need to get pissed off. We're just talking. Guy, you become nasty. Here we are, two Jews looking for friends, and you turn on us.
He was, you know, as you said, backstage, he was soft-spoken and elegant and charming and welcoming.
And pantsless.
And he always was backstage without his pants on, because that's what the old-school entertainers do. They don't put their pants on until they go on stage. So he's back there in tuxedo shirt. And a robe on.
Yep. Close your legs, Don.
And no pants. He's back there. And, you know, I think the last time that I talked with him, it might have been 5-6 years ago, something like that. So he's, you know, 85, somewhere in that neighborhood. Slowed down. You know, it's a little bit slower, walking slowly, etc. He gets on stage, and it is like a tank on stage. He turns it on, and he's got... He's Don Rickles, just as sharp as ever and hilarious as ever.
One of the last things he said to me, it was on this station, was in an interview, and he goes, so Steve, still on the radio. You know, a lot of people left radio. You don't have to stay on it. There are other things you can do. And he goes, maybe get a paper route. He goes, do people still get the paper? He goes, a part-time job, something outside of show business. I'm just trying to help.
That's great. Isn't that the greatest feeling?
You know, getting ripped by Rickles. Come on.
We're talking backstage and having a really sweet conversation. We're taking a picture, and he zings me like right in the middle of it. And I was 20 feet tall. It's like I just got zinged by Don Rickles.
It's the best.
It's the greatest.
It's the best.
It's the greatest.
Heaven got a lot funnier last night.
Sure
and,
did.
You know, he's reunited with his son, Larry. And as I tweeted out last night, he didn't die. He just changed gigs. He just took a long-term engagement in heaven.
God bless him. Sure gave us a lot of great entertainment.
Thank you. Have a great weekend, buddy.
Bye.
And we'll come back with a big story next. And got a cool book, Andrea, coming up. A cool book. A book about women pirates.
I know.
Female pirates.
You know what you can't, Steve? You can't argue with that.
Badass Women of the High Seas. You're going to love this book. Stand by for that. Before we get to that, let's get to the big story next on 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show, 720 WGN.
We will continue to keep an eye on developments this morning following the launch of those Tomahawk missiles at an air base in Syria.
Yep.
We'll also possibly connect with President Trump speaking scheduled sometime around 9:30 our time. But I want to welcome to the studio right now, Laura Mae Sook Duncombe. What can I call you, Laura, that's shorter than that?
Laura's just fine.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, I love the idea of the book. These are literally the badass women of the high seas. Has anybody ever taken on pirate women before?
Not to this degree. You know, they're sort of scattered across history, footnote here, paragraph there, but this is the largest collection of pirate women.
Cool. The book's called Pirate Women, the Princesses, Prostitutes, and Privateers Who Ruled the Seven Seas. You're going to be at Women and Children First, 5233 North Clark Street, tonight at 7:30, doing a reading and a book signing. This is your first book, right?
This is.
It's a bit of a whirlwind, I'm guessing.
It absolutely is, but I've been having a wonderful time.
So where's the interest come from? Because, you know, the modern-day pirate, we think of the pirates off the coast of Africa taking these giant ships. And other than that, it's the romanticized version of all we've seen in the movies, right?
Absolutely. Well, that's certainly where I got my start. I was a big Peter Pan fan as a child. And so when my parents took me to Disney World, I went on the Pirates of the Caribbean ride. And it was a pirate's life for me after that. I was hooked.
Literally, right?
Yes.
And as you know, Steve, Laura, you're an attorney. You don't currently practice law, but you have such a great background. Where'd the interest in pirates come from? And what's one of the biggest myths, I guess, that we've heard?
The biggest myth, I think, probably would be the pirates bury their treasure. That is pretty much a whole cloth fabrication from Robert Louis Stevenson. Most of the things people think about when they think about pirates come from Treasure Island. And the reality was really quite different, which was one of the many reasons I wanted to write this book, just sort of to take apart the myths and the legends a little bit.
So how hard was it to find research on these stories? Because I would assume, timing being what it was, these women weren't written about the way the men were.
Absolutely. And even the men really were sensationalized to sell copies. You know, the nature of piracy, they don't really file W-2s. You know, they're not a law-abiding citizens. I know, right? So they weren't really, records weren't kept of them officially. But there are, you know, for some of the more notorious ones, we have trial transcripts. We have newspaper articles of the time. And then, of course, the myths and legends. So it is a treasure hunt to sort of track these women down. But that's what makes it so rewarding when you hit pay dirt.
Andrea, I was looking at the notes for the book,
yeah.
And because I've not read the book yet. But Laura, correct me if I'm wrong. Was there an Asian pirate who managed thousands of ships at one point in the early 19th century?
Yes, absolutely. That is Cheng Yi Sao, who is the most successful pirate of all time. She makes Blackbeard look kind of like a chump. She pirated longer. She had more ships. She had more men. And when she retired from piracy, she did so with the blessing of the Chinese government, who paid her crew pensions, basically to get them to stop pirating. So she went out on top on the government's dime.
And she looked good doing it, Steve, and then she went out to lunch to celebrate.
Well, here's the thing I don't get, right? Because you think about the early 19th century and you think about pirating, you think what could be more, again, sexist or more limiting for women than that? How did this woman, this Asian woman in particular, become such a legend, and how did she control all these men?
Well, she did marry into the fleet, but it was much, much smaller in scope and scale when her husband was a pirate. And after his death, she just built it. I think she would have had to have been incredibly good at what she did. You know, she would have commanded respect. And they made so much money and were so successful. I think, you know, her crew couldn't argue with the results. Very few pirates were able to retire. And her pirates were the only ones who retired with a government pension. So she was very good to them and they were very good to her.
I think initially, you know, you said yo-ho-ho and about Pirates of the Caribbean. That's kind of what maybe our first experiences as kids with pirate. And it's cool to be a pirate for Halloween with the eye patch. But I really like that you dispel the myth that the women were just the wenches and kind of on the arms of the men, that they, too, like this particular pirate, kind of took control.
Absolutely. I think that the sea is a great equalizer. You know, like any extreme sport, you sort of everybody's in it together. And as long as you're pulling your weight, some of these superficial, you know, gender constructs are stripped away. And as long as you did your share in the crew, you were able to be a part of it. So, yeah, you know, women, as long as there's been a sea and things to steal, there have been pirates. And as long as there have been male pirates, there have been women pirates. So.
Well, some of this is myth making too, right? Because some of these stories, you had to find the facts amongst the fiction. But was there violence? Were these women violent in controlling their pirate ships and their empire?
Absolutely. There were many women pirates who were well renowned for their cruelty above and beyond some of their male counterparts. Maria Cobham, for example, just really loved chopping people up.
She got to get a hobby.
Yeah,
really.
I mean, no kidding. Would there be modern day pirate women too?
I don't know as much about that. I imagine there may be some women on the Somali ships. I drew the line at the turn of the, you know, the 21st century, yeah. Just because you had to stop somewhere. But I can't imagine that there aren't, because there were women at every stage throughout history. So I don't know why they'd stop now.
Yeah, exactly.
Feels like a movie.
Doesn't
it? It really does feel like a movie. And I'm kind of surprised it hasn't been made yet. But is anybody talking to you about that?
You know, not yet. So, Hollywood, this is a great opportunity. If you're listening, you know, give me a call.
Yeah, it really is.
I'm interested. Let's do this.
Come on. And I assume because the book is so well reviewed that they're going to ask you to do another one. There's plenty of material here.
I think so. I'm happy to talk about pirates for the rest of my days. I don't mind being the pirate lady one bit. So.
Now, you have a son or a daughter?
I have a son.
How old is he?
He is 13 months old.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you so much. He's the best.
I look forward to him getting old enough to go, I'm sorry, Mom, what was your first book about?
Yeah.
It's Laura Sook Duncombe, author of Pirate Women, The Princesses, Prostitutes, and Privateers Who Ruled the Seven Seas. Again, she'll read it and ask questions, or I should say answer questions about it. Sure, she'll ask questions too. Tonight, 7:30, Women and Children First, 5233 North Clark. And congratulations on it. It's not easy to write a book, and you picked a particularly tough topic. But again, it's a movie. I love this idea, so it's really nice to have you on the show.
I'm with you, Steve. Thank you so much. I should also add, it's National Beer Day, so there will be beer at the reading.
Oh.
And also, Women and Children First is BYOB. So, you know, grab a bottle of rum and
Dave?
Come on down.
I'm right here, Steve.
That is one of my favorite bookstores in the city, in Andersonville. It is fantastic. It's a great venue, so get on out there.
Yeah, thank you. Come on down, everybody.
Yeah, so if Dave stumbles in and he's thirsty, don't be surprised.
Yeah.
Safe travels. Congrats on the book. Pirate
thank you
Women,
so much.
The Princesses, Prostitutes, and Privateers Who Ruled the Seven Seas. You know what I always say? You're careless. You'll lose a copy. Get two. Get three. Traffic first. Here's Mary on 720 WGN. All right, so again, I said this at the top of the show, but I'm going to repeat it now, and I don't want it to shock anyone. I don't want anyone to be hurt. I don't want you to drive off a road. I support President Trump, and I think he did a good job in the decision he made yesterday. Let it sink
moment,
in.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Let it sink in for a second. I have seen nothing this morning that makes me think anything differently. Well, Trump, certainly doesn't know the ins and outs of a Tomahawk missile. That's not the president's job. And the president does have to make the final decision. And I think Trump made the right decision in the attack that happened last night from an American ship, 59 or more Tomahawk missiles, taking out a Syrian airfield where we firmly believe the gas attack on the Syrian people emanated the other day. It doesn't matter what he said before. It doesn't matter what he tweeted about Obama. It doesn't matter what Tillerson said before. It doesn't matter that they changed their opinion. What matters is they acted against this animal that killed babies, that killed children. They killed women and children and babies and little kids, too. And something had to be done. We believe as many as six Syrian soldiers may have been killed, but that's a local report. Russia has responded with, they're very upset about this, but Russia, as again, Tillerson, who's a friend of Putin's, from the old days, Tillerson said, look, they're either incompetent or, and what was the other word he used? They're ignorant or incompetent? It was one of those two, or maybe both, but Rex Tillerson came out very verbally about this. This is a good, this may well be Trump's biggest win so far. Now, Congress is chirping about how if anything else goes on in Syria, we need to approve it, and that's true. We're not declaring war here. We're simply taking action and saying this will not stand. As the disaster that is Syria is now 15 years deep and 400,000 Syrians have died, taking any sort of action retaliatory to keep the Syrian Air Force for even a few days from being able to fly those planes and drop more poison on their own people. Well, frankly, it's the least we could do. So I salute President Donald J. Trump this morning.
And President Trump is with China's president, as we know, Steve. They're meeting today about 9:30. We will see President Trump for the first time following last night's missile strike. He doesn't have a press conference or anything like that scheduled, but is expected to give a quick statement to the media. That'll be at 9:30 our time in about half an hour.
This is the Steve Cochran Show.
The grounds crew is told by this umpiring crew and the crew chief, John Hirschbeck, to bring out the tarp.
In a weird way, was that a positive for you guys to take a break during the rain delay?
I don't like rain delays, but
yeah.
But it gave us a chance, you know, to actually talk to each other on a one-on-one level with the whole team and put things into realization.
Zobrist stands a base hit. Cubs will take the lead. Almora dig into the plate. Zobrist delivers 7-6 in the 10th.
Hey, hey, holy mackerel. No doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way. Hey, hey, hey.
Here's the 0-1. This is going to be a tough play. Bryant, the Cubs win the World Series. Bryant makes the play. It's over.
The good Lord wants the Cubs to win.
This is the year.
Going to be 65 tomorrow, 70 Monday, 70 Tuesday. Come on. Time for you to sing.
Baseball season's underway. Well, you better get ready for a brand new day. Hey, Chicago, what do you say? The Cubs are gonna win today.
You know my two favorite Chicago sports songs are, Dave?
Let's see, I can guess. What are they, Steve?
Well, it'll be this one.
Yeah.
And na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na every time the Blackhawks score a goal. That's all you need.
I was thinking that or Here Come the Hawks.
Tom Verducci joins us, and couldn't be a bigger fan of Tom's. Love what he does. Well, I can't speak to Tom's personal life. I'll have to get back and check with him on that. But three-time National Sports Writer of the Year, won it again this year, third year in a row, is Cubs Way. The Cubs Way is debuting on the New York Times bestsellers list in its first week on sale. Congratulations on the success already, Mr. Verducci, and welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, and thanks for having me.
I've been a big fan for a long time, and I love the work you do. But, Cubs are on WGN for 80-plus years. We saw a lot of bad baseball. We aired a lot of bad baseball. And when the Ricketts revival was beginning, and Theo came in and was rebuilding this thing. Tom, I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't buy in. I didn't know that I could take three or four more bad years. And now he is a certifiable genius, isn't he?
Yeah, that is. I think they are minting the plaque in Cooperstown as we speak, because he's already in my book. And there's only been six front office executives who really had the role, a traditional role of team architect, general manager. So he's going to be the next one because, you know, what he did in Boston, but especially I think what he did in Chicago, which to me topped what he did in Boston because, as you mentioned, this was building something from the ground up, changing a culture, flipping the entire roster. And what was amazing to me in writing this book is he had a blueprint in mind from day one that would take about 4 or 5 years, and it basically came true to the absolute detail. Everything he wanted to accomplish in 5 years, he did.
Did he take the job with Ricketts' approval that this could take 5 years? And at any point did Ricketts, you know, go, this is taking too long? Were they on the same page from the beginning?
They were on the same page. Yeah, I'm not sure, you know, the fans were as patient. And I think Theo tried to be very transparent with people from the beginning to buy himself some time to say, you know, listen, I know there's some guys here that are veteran players. We're going to have to move because they're not part of what we want to be in 3, 4, 5 years. And there were growing pains there without question. It was interesting to me talking to Theo. He knew pretty much second half of 2013 that the organization had turned a corner. Now, you couldn't see it on the surface. You certainly couldn't see it on the major league level. But that's when he really had stocked the farm system with position players who he could tell were going to be impact players in the big leagues. So I think he saw it before everybody else saw it. But I think Ricketts was on board that this was – he didn't want a team that you know, just popped up for 1 year and then disappeared again. Wanted something sustainable. And if you look at this roster now, it sure looks like it's sustainable.
Tom Verducci is going to be in town with Theo at 5 o'clock Tuesday night at the Standard Club on South Plymouth Court. A little Q&A talking about the Cubs way, the zen of building the best team in baseball and breaking the curse. Out and available everywhere. And Dave, as I always say, get two copies. You're careless, so you'll lose the first one. Say hi to Tom.
Of course. Tom, nice to talk to you. In your mind, was it that Theo basically took them to the bottom? I mean, he not only flipping the roster, but basically saying, okay, we're going to have some real tough years here. We have to start this thing over. Was that the difference? Was that what set him apart from his predecessors, some very able baseball executives who came here and just weren't able to do it because he started from scratch?
Yeah, I think that is it, because the worst place to be in baseball is the middle of the road, where you have a team that maybe is built to win 82, 83 games, and you're hoping everything breaks right, you can get a wild card spot. That's a very dangerous place to be. I mean, to get to a sustainable point, you really do need to strip it down. So I think that was the difference. And the difference also for me, and this was really important to Theo, was making sure you get the right kind of players. You know, it wasn't just talented players, but he wanted to build this team around everyday players, more so than pitchers, and guys of high character. And why did he want to do that? Because he did need to change the culture. It wasn't just bringing in good players. He wanted to basically get rid of that losing culture, get a new mindset in there. And he knew that starting pitchers really don't lead a team. They can lead a pitching staff, but they're not necessarily team leaders playing once every fifth day. So that's why he had his sights set on Anthony Rizzo, probably his first big move. And then he had Chris Bryant, he had Kyle Schwarber, and Addison Russell. Those were the real four pillars of his rebuilding. He had them within, what, two and a half years. Yeah.
Was Joe Maddon the final piece?
Absolutely, because they love Rick Renteria, but the young players just weren't developing at the rate that they really hoped for. And, you know, Theo knew Joe Maddon, especially competing against him in the AL East when Theo was in Boston. And he could see that, number one, Joe wasn't afraid to run games unconventionally, which you pretty much had to do with the Rays when you're competing against the Red Sox and the Yankees. But also he saw on the field that the young players in the Rays just seemed to be so relaxed and loose that Joe was getting the best out of a player. So he liked that vibe that Joe established. And he wanted that with his young position players in Chicago. So to me, you know, this is like a 5,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. Joe Maddon was the last piece. There's no question about that.
I remember, Tom, a couple of years ago at the Cubs convention, and it was our last Cubs convention, and I'm sitting next to Theo and Jed Hoyer. And one of the first questions from the audience, I'm moderating the panel, and one of the first questions from the audience comes up, goes, a guy stands up, and, you know, it's Chicago. It's like New York. People are going to tell you what they think. And looks right at Ricketts, or I should say right at Theo, and says, I've been a season ticket holder for however many years. He goes, you expect me to continue to pay for this product? And, you know, you could hear a pin drop, and Theo just said, well, I'm sorry you feel that way. And I'm going, wow, that's either the coolest thing anybody's ever said, or Theo's a jerk. And, you know, 18 months later, he's on the verge of the World Series. Did he ever doubt it? Did he ever have that moment where he thought, maybe this is taking too long? Maybe I'm not the magic man.
I think maybe when Rajay Davis hit the home run, he started to doubt it.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, he told me he had some deep, dark thoughts when that happened, because then he felt like 5 years of work were all going down the drain in Game 7. So I think there were doubts. I know there were doubts during Game 7 that he would win the World Series, but I don't think there were doubts that he was on the right track. You know, so many things have to go right to win a World Series, as you saw last year. But I don't think he ever doubted that the blueprint wasn't something that someday was going to work. And he pretty much stuck to it as well. So I think, you know, I understand the fans wanting to see something quickly. That's the day and age we live in. And it's funny you mentioned that question at the fan fest. But Theo told me that his days in Boston kind of prepared him for Chicago. In a major market, there's so many expectations and pressures on players that you do need a different kind of player. The kind of players who can stand up to that kind of scrutiny. And I think the young players in the Cubs were amazing in that regard, where, you know, they get history thrown in their faces, and guys like Chris Bryant and Addison Russell are saying, we'll just write our own kind of history. I don't think it bothered the team at all, the 108-year narrative that was in play.
You know, Dave, you and I have talked about this off the air, but Tom, I'd be curious to get your take on this because baseball is show business, and show business loves a success story, and then show business likes to copy it. Does this give other teams, with all their financial interests, because people have no idea how expensive it is to run a Major League Baseball team, but are other teams going to have the confidence to break it down the way the Cubs did, to take the heat from the fans and do it, or is this a one-off?
I think other teams are, and I think to some degree you could say the White Sox are doing that. You know, they're not there yet, and I think you may see them in the course of the summer trade some more pieces to get to that point where you want all your young players to hit at the same time. And that's, you know, you're asking your fans, as you know, right there with the Cubs, to kind of sign off 2-3 years, maybe 4 years. But, again, the hope is that it's something sustainable. And I do think a lot of more organizations, Atlanta is on the verge of doing that. Philadelphia is kind of coming out of that arc. I do think people realize that where you are in the winning curve is the most important thing in baseball these days. But teams are staying out of the middle. Teams that are going for it are absolutely all in. And if you're not going for it, you have to be all out. So I do think that's something that other teams will try to copy.
Dave, I got 30 seconds. Last word from you.
Well, I just wonder, Tom, as someone who's covered the renaissance of the Red Sox and the Steinbrenner Yankees and all the great stories in baseball, where do you rank covering the Cubs World Series championship last year?
No, this is the greatest baseball story that I've covered. It's my 36th year covering Major League Baseball. And one reason I wrote the book is watching the Cubs early in the postseason last year, I began to think, and everybody knew the possibility and how big it would be if the Cubs won, but it really became real to me that this team probably was good enough to win a World Series. And I realized it was the best baseball story of my lifetime, and I knew I had to write about it. And I felt that way watching the games. I felt privileged, actually, you know, not just knowing about the Ron Santos and Ernie Banks of the world, but people who covered baseball, people who followed baseball, Cubs fans who never got a chance to see a World Series championship. So I did feel a privilege to be, you know, down the field with Fox covering these games and now being able to write about it. So as much as I love the Red Sox story, I think this one's even bigger.
Three-time National Sports Writer of the Year. It's the great Tom Verducci, the Cubs way. Congratulations on it, Tom. I think you nail it in every way, but then I'd expect nothing less. And we'll look forward to seeing you next week in town with Theo. Have a great trip.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, see you. Again, the Cubs way from Tom Verducci. More coming up. Steve Cochran Show, 720 WGN.
Oh, what do you feel like doing tonight?
What do you want to do?
So what do you want to do? Friday, what do you want to do? You want to do anything?
What do you want to do?
Andrea is here to help you out. What you want to do? What you going to do? What do we want to do? Who's it sponsored by?
Steve, we are sponsored by Majestic Star Casino. We thank them for that. We have a big comedy show coming up tomorrow night, April 8th.
Where's that?
In Arlington Heights. Steve Cochran, John DeCoss, and me.
Andrea Darlis.
We're going to have a great time. It's tomorrow night at 7:30 in Arlington Heights. Please be there and hang out with us.
You know, I don't know that there's any tickets left, but you could certainly try.
You know, you can wait outside the door and wait for us to come out, sign a few autographs.
Yeah, that's where the paparazzi will be.
Exactly.
Let's go to the birthday boy who's on the phone right now. Woo! John DeCoss. Happy birthday, buddy.
Oh, my Lord.
Happy birthday to you.
Yeah, we just wrote this. And I know you're the music director, but we just wrote this. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
To you.
All right, I thought that went well. What do you think, John?
Oh, my Lord. You guys, so you're on tour now?
Yeah,
to
pretty
you.
Much. Happy birthday, John.
Thank you so much.
To you.
So nice. That's what I thought.
Hey, did you get my message last night?
Mike has no rhythm. Jake has no rhythm.
Hey, I left you a message last night. Did you get my message?
Actually, no.
I texted you this morning. Did you get my text?
No, I have you blocked.
I'll call you after the show. All right, so we continue with what do you want to do?
Oh, Andrea? That would be me. Well, aside from Arlington Heights, Dave Ennett has a special event that he is attending this weekend as well. What's that, Dave?
For anyone who was unable to get tickets to the comedy show tomorrow night, may I suggest a night for victory. Northwestern football will be hosting an event tomorrow evening at the rooftop lounge of the I.O. Godfrey Hotel in Chicago. The event features food stations, chef-inspired cocktails, live and silent auctions. Ted Albrecht and I will be emceeing along with Coach Pat Fitzgerald. Starts at 6 tomorrow night. Tickets are available. For information, 847-467-4321 or email wildcatfundevents@northwestern.edu or just email me.
There you go. A couple other things going on. Ali Wong is at the Chicago Theater Saturday night. Two shows, 7 p.m. and 10 o'clock. And the Black Women's Expo, everything business, books, music, home, health, hair, food and drink, all catered toward black women. That'll be Friday and Saturday and Sunday at McCormick Place. And one more for you guys, too, if you're into retro rummaging, the annual Chirp Record Fair plus Vintage Chicago, partnering up for all kinds of retro goodies. This is sponsored by the Chicago Journeyman Plumbers Local Union 130. It's 1340 West Washington Street, $25 admission. Gets you all everything vintage this weekend.
What do you want to do? What do you want to do? We gave you a bunch of ideas, and we'll come back with the big story next on 720 WGN.
Live from the Allstate Showcase Studio, this is the Steve Cochran Show on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Music is a world within itself, with a language we all understand.
Well, your long winter nightmare is over. After a week of wacky weather, it's going to be hot and sunny and nice for the immediate future, so enjoy that. If you're getting out, Andre, you mentioned the Black Women's Expo.
Yeah.
This weekend, and I just want to grab a minute here with Patricia Andrews-Keenan to talk a little bit about this. Good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm over at the Expo now. We're just getting ready to do our ribbon cutting, and we're opening our doors at 10 a.m. this morning.
Well, good for you. That's exciting. And I just saw a note that said CeCe Winans and Vivica Fox are going to be in.
Absolutely. So Saturday, we have CeCe Winans coming in. She's going to perform at 1 o'clock. And Saturday afternoon, Vivica Fox is going to do a session talking about aging gracefully, which I'm sure we all want to get a little piece of. So she's going to be with us as well from 3 to 4:30.
Is it easier for Vivica Fox because she's so darn beautiful, or is it does she have good advice for everybody?
Well, I hope she has good advice for everybody. So I've heard her talk a couple of times. I think she's got some good things to share.
The Black Women's Expo hours, again, today, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., tomorrow, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and Sunday from 11 to 6. Tickets are only $20, which is great.
Right.
And there's a teen summit as well.
There's a teen summit today. A lot of the work today is around kids and families. We have the 100 Black Men of Chicago coming in and talking about to young African-American males. We have entertainment for kids. So this is a perfect day if your listeners are out on spring break. It's a good day to bring your kids in and let them take a part in some of the fun things that are going on.
Steve, this is really growing. 30,000 people from 14 to 15 states expected to attend. And again, there's everything from business, books, music, home health, food and drink, and hair. What else can a woman ask for?
That's right. There'll be a lot of fun stuff. We have some great hair care companies. We have My Black is Beautiful here. We have Luster Products, which is a 60-year-old Chicago company. So anything you want to know about hair, anything you want to buy, there'll be shopping for the women, purses, dresses, jewelry, just about anything. You can do it here at the Expo.
I got a buddy of mine who is in the health and beauty business, and he told me a long time ago, and I think this is true, Chicago is like the home office for black women's hair. Any innovations that have come up through the years, most of them come up through Chicago. Is that true?
Yes, absolutely. Some of the biggest hair care companies in the early days were founded right here in Chicago. Yeah. Luster Products is 60 years old. There was Soft Sheen Carson. You know, some of these companies have gotten bought over the years, but Luster Products is still a black-owned company operating out of the Back of the Yards neighborhood 60 years this year, and they're going to be doing seminars here. My Black is Beautiful, which is about 15 years old, was founded by African-American women within the P&G organization. They're going to be doing some fabulous seminars here with many of your listeners might know Afrobella. She's one of the early bloggers. She's going to be here. Lovia Jai, who just signed with Shonda Rhimes. They're going to be doing a session
been here over the weekend, too, so it's a great place to be.
Yeah, and are you impressed that a bald guy knew that little statistic? Huh?
Not too bad.
Patricia Andrews Keenan, the Black Women's Expo. It's at the Hyatt Regency Chicago, 151 East Wacker, for a big weekend.
No. Let me correct that. We're at McCormick Place.
Last night you were there. Yeah.
We're at McCormick Place all weekend.
My fault.
And there's still tickets available, too. And then the hashtag is going to be SheMatters. So tweet and put your pictures on Instagram all weekend. Right, Patricia?
We love it. And if you hurry up, you can still get some discount tickets at Walgreens. Walgreens is a big sponsor.
Look at you. Didn't miss a trick. Enjoy your weekend and then get some sleep. Thanks for coming on. We'll take a break, come back, and talk to, is this the founder, the chef of Fat Rice?
Oh, Steve, one of my favorite restaurants in Chicago.
Yeah, we're going to feed you before the show's over, and Bill and Wendy are here on 720 WGN. The 30th anniversary of Frontera Grill, and Chef Rick Bayless partnering with Family Farm to throw a good food party of the year later this month. And, of course, we have no shortage of great restaurants in Chicago. Andre, you want to introduce who's in studio?
Oh, one of my favorite restaurants in Chicago, newer to the Chicago area. Four and a half years.
Oh,
has it been that fast already? But this is one of my favorite go-to places on the north side. It's called Fat Rice. I want to describe it as like Pan-Asian fusion or Thai meets Chinese, but we're going to have Chef Abe Comlin, who's in studio with us, kind of dishing out some of the arroz, the fat rice, Steve. This is a wonderful dish.
Hi, Steve. How are you? Thanks for inviting me.
Doing great. And what's the elevator pitch on the restaurant for people that know the name but have never been?
Well, the restaurant is in Logan Square at Sacramento Diversity, and we really focus on the food of Macau, which is a mixture of Portuguese and Chinese, Malay and Indian, but also exploring kind of global Portuguese in general. So not only things from Macau, but also things from Goa, India, Portugal, Brazil, etc.
How's a nice guy like you know this stuff?
Well, myself, I am Portuguese, and the town I grew up in, Lowell, Massachusetts, was 30% Southeast Asian, and I really was interested in those flavors and got a taste for them at a young age. And then as a young chef, just started experimenting with those flavors. One day I found out about Macau and went there and traveled and learned.
Grandma, mom, dad, uncles, somebody else inspire you as well?
Definitely grandparents. My two grandmothers were a huge inspiration for me and encouraged me a lot. I cooked with them a lot because my mom was a single mother, and and I would hang out with them and cook with them a lot. Also, you know, I'm inspired by food. It was the dawn of food TV when I was young. So
what is the thing on the menu everybody comes back for, everybody wants?
Well, of course, that's our signature dish, the arroz gordo, or the fat rice, which is similar to that of a paella, has a sofrito-scented rice with pickled raisins in it, char-siu pork, Portuguese chicken thighs on top, Chinese-style sausage, and prawns, clams, a whole multitude
good
of things
God,
that people
man.
Love to dig into.
Oh, my God, Steve, it's the perfect dish to
good
share,
God.
Too. Well, you can eat it all yourself, but... which I've done, but
yeah,
it's a great dish to share. And if you can, I mean, the food tastes delicious, but the showcase right now smells so good. It's all of the different spices that you kind of blend and add into that, Chef.
Absolutely. And today we are we were actually doing something a little bit different than the arroz gordo to promote local farms for Rick Bayless's Frontera 30. And we're doing a really nice sorrel gazpacho with fresh-made queijo fresco, which is a fresh cheese made from Kilgus Farm Creamery, Warp Farm radishes, and nice little herbs from our rooftop garden.
And Rick's Frontera Farmer Foundation has made nearly $2 million in grants to Midwestern farmers in the last 14 or 15 years, so good for him for continuing that. I always love having some of the world's greatest chefs on the show and asking, do you cook when you go home?
I do cook at home. Usually it's very simple. I really do love on Sundays. Usually I have half of the day off because we're open for brunch on Sundays. We're not open for dinner, so I always skip out a little bit early and try to get to the Logan Square Farmers Market and grab some fresh vegetables when in season, and really just take them home and you know, simply prepare them, whether it's roasted spring onions or carrots, and just pair it with you know, nice simple things, potatoes, a little bit of bread, etc.
But we're never going to catch you like in a Taco Bell drive-thru or curling up and having a good cry with a bag of Cheetos on a Friday night. None of that?
Not anymore. I'm reformed.
Chicago really does have some of the best farmers markets. You know, the one in Logan Square, the one in South Loop, the one here in Lincoln Park. Wonderful. Do you notice, too, Chef, more of an effort kind of to focus on community gardens and to bring farm-to-table, you know, restaurants, make them more prevalent and have locally sustained and produced vegetables and fruits?
Definitely. I think that the public is becoming more aware. The general consumer is becoming more aware. Obviously, people like Rick Bayless and Matthias Merges and Chef Jason Hamill have been on the forefront of this for years and helping the public understand that good food comes from farms and is raised without pesticides and animals without antibiotics. And it is something that many, many chefs in the city are doing and pushing forward. And I think people are just becoming more aware and starting to cook better, cook healthier, tastier.
Absolutely. Oh my God. You can't beat it. And what are you preparing now? That's part of the fat rice?
So this is the gazpacho. This is the gazpacho that we're doing for Rick Bayless's.
Yeah, are we going to taste test this around the room now? Because some of us have to talk.
Absolutely.
All right, why don't you guys taste test? Tell me what you're eating and then tell me what you think.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.
He's preparing. Hold on.
No, so, Dave, what do you have?
Well,
you
I don't have it
Dave?
Just yet.
We're getting there. Here you go.
Chef is finishing up here.
We're doing tableside presentation here.
Yes. Yes, this is a very nice presentation. And
there's radishes in it, and those are my favorite.
Oh, I love radishes.
It sort of reminds me of how I met Andrea when I was flipping shrimp into my hat at that restaurant. Remember that?
I love when you did that. You still do it the best I've ever seen any chef do it. No offense, Chef.
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Pretty good.
This is very good.
I can flip a shrimp.
There's a little kick to this, Chef.
Oh, yeah, we have a little spice. That actually comes from the Piri Piri peppers. That is another local farm that we have here from Seedling Farm. And maybe you dug deep on that one.
I think I did dig a little deep.
Wow, this is
got a delayed
wonderful.
Kick.
Yes. I'm loving the peppers. They're not choking
me. Oh, I was going to say, how about the smell, too? I mean, I could literally just smell this all day. It's delicious.
Wonderful. Well, thank you.
And it's got radishes in it, too?
Yep. It's got Warp Farm radishes, a little bit of basil, the queso fresco that we made in-house from Kilgus Farm Creamery, and a little bit of that olive oil infused with that Piri Piri from Seedling Farm, which is a project that we had a couple of years ago with Seedling when they had a strong freeze and the stone fruit crop, which they are most produce, kind of died essentially, and they didn't have any stone fruit. And he started asking chefs, "What can I produce for you that you can't get?" And one of the things for me was heirloom variety of chili. It's about hundreds of years old, called the Piri Piri pepper, and so we get about 500 pounds of those from him every year.
Wow. It's delicious.
Fantastic.
And you know what, Steve, the best part, it's green.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's basil, but I presume that's the green leafy.
The leafy comes from spinach.
Spinach
from City Lights Farm, as well as sorrel from Warp Farm as well. And yeah, you know, now's the time for green, right? When we start to thaw, we want these bright, vibrant minerals and vitamins from them.
I have a question. For at home, you can't just all of a sudden switch from your home run and frozen pizza to cooking and making all your food with every local. I'd be spending every day having to get produce and things like that to my house to assemble for a meal. And then you don't always use it all. And I'm trying to, what are some of the basic things we can incorporate into our daily lives at home if we're not eating at fat rice? Well, we're getting stuff from a farm, but it's not overwhelming for me as the person running the household.
Sure. And I think, you know, I think in a fast paced life, it is not always easy to just eat local every day. But, you know, if you have your, I'm sorry, Tombstone Pizza.
Home run, whatever your frozen pizza may be.
But you can always pick up a bag of greens or a cucumber or something and have things that will go next to that. And of course, you know, not always picking up the most perishable things. I mean, beets will last for a while. cucumbers or potatoes or anything. These will last for some time in your refrigerator. But I think the thing that we want to encourage, and you know, and for me, I always love the adventure of going to the farmer's market or going to you know, small co-op or even Whole Foods. And Whole Foods also has a lot of support for local farms as well. Going there, seeing what's fresh, picking out what's fresh, and even if you don't know what is and it looks beautiful, grab it, go home. Google's a hell of a thing.
The blending of Frontera the flavors, 30, too. Fantastic.
Frontera30.org is the website we would send you to for the 30th anniversary celebration of Rick Bayless and Frontera Grill. And get to Fat Rice, for instance, tonight, and start celebrating and having your take your taste buds out for a little party with Chef Abe Conlon of Fat Rice. It's nice to meet you. Congratulations on all your success.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.